This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is Nuala McGovern, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Now, did you follow the Agatha Christie trial, as it was called? It was between Rebecca Vardy and Colleen Rooney over leaked social media posts. Well, two of my guests today are intimately familiar with the whole saga off at the Footballers' Wives. They created a play on a stage that is a football pitch, and they use the court transcripts verbatim. So they incorporate the messages sent by participants. You know, as I was watching it, I was wondering, would your private messages stand up to public scrutiny? There is currently, you might have seen in the news today, a debate between messaging platforms and the government about whether platforms should monitor users as part of the online safety bill to try and root out child abuse images. And do you believe private should or indeed can ever really remain private in this day and age? What about screenshots? Well, with all of these debates, of course, there's always the question, who is protected and who suffers? You can text the programme. The number is 84844, text charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Women's Hour, and you can also email us through our website. Staying with phones, we're also going to talk about the planned emergency alert system on Sunday and how domestic abuse charities are advising those who may have a hidden second phone for safety. So that's coming up. We also continue our conversations with our Women's Hour power list today. It is number four on our list, Ellie Downey, one of Britain's most decorated gymnasts who has spoken out about abusive behaviour in British gymnastics. I'm looking forward to speaking to her. And you'll also meet the woman playing small pipes with a big sound. But first, let's turn to a new report calling on the government to eliminate appalling disparities in maternal deaths between black and white women. The Women and Equalities Committee of Parliament, they've been looking at why black women are 3.7 times more likely to die in pregnancy, childbirth, or 6 weeks after giving birth. Asian women are 1.8 times more likely, according to UK figures for 2018 to 2020. And I really want to hear your experiences on this one, good or bad, as a black or Asian woman when you were pregnant or perhaps a new mother. How were you treated before, during or after? Again, the text number is 84844, social media at BBC Women's Hour, or email us through our website. If you'd prefer to send a WhatsApp message or a voice note, that number is 03700 100 444. This has been an issue you might know that we've covered for a long time now. And although things are improving slightly, MPs say it must be given more priority. Caroline Noakes is chair of the committee which published its report this morning. And she was joined by Sandra Igwe from the Motherhood Group. They're a group that support black mothers. I spoke to them both just a little earlier. And Caroline began by giving me more detail.
The message we got from black women was that they felt they were not listened to during their childbirth experience, and they were felt that they were marginalised, that they were facing microaggressions. And it's just wrong that anybody should face that sort of racism during treatment in our NHS. And so we are simply saying that the NHS needs to do better. There needs to be more training, make sure that staff are culturally competent, and that the Department for Health, the Royal Colleges, those experts working in the field need to listen to organisations like Birthrights, like Five Times More, and act upon the information that black women are providing them with.
Well, I want to bring in Sandra here, who is the founder of the Motherhood Group. When you hear some of the issues that Caroline is raising there, I'm just wondering what your experience was and perhaps if some of those things are resonating.
Absolutely. They all resonate with my personal lived experience and also the experiences that I've also heard through the Birth Rights Inquiry, which I co-chaired as well. You know, my pregnancy, giving birth on both occasions, I was ignored when I raised my concerns. I was dismissed. All of my concerns and worries were brushed under the carpet. And I absolutely knew that I was treated differently based on the colour of my skin, which I actually raised with the healthcare practitioners on the day. And I really felt like I was dehumanised. And I didn't believe that my words were actually taken seriously. And it felt like I was a nuisance in the system rather than being on the receiving end of, you know, adequate care.
So let's talk about that, Sandra, because I'm just thinking you're in a pretty vulnerable position. You're about to give birth. You speak out. And what do people say back to you?
They're not saying much. They're saying that actually my cries, my screams didn't coincide with my labour contraction. So why are you crying, Sandra? In fact, a practitioner, a doctor said she's not going to administer me any epidural until I stopped crying. And she walked out of the room. And I had to beg and plead for her to come back. And she came back 2 hours later, to which I had to stay still and bite my lips because, you know, the notion that Black women cannot even show their emotions or express themselves in the fear of being seen as angry or aggressive.
And you have two children, correct?
I have two children.
Yeah. Any better the second time?
No, even worse. And I didn't get any pain relief at all when I asked and begged for pain relief for hours and hours. And in fact, the inquiry also reflects that Black women are the least likely to be able to get pain relief. So my experience wasn't a standalone. It echoes many other experiences faced by Black women.
Caroline, let's go back to this. You mentioned like this is 20 years that this has been known about. The Conservatives have been in power for a very long time. Why do you think they're not taking action and that the interventions aren't happening in a way that was previously recommended?
Well, we heard from the Health and Social Care Select Committee 2 years ago that there needed to be between £250 and £350 million more go into maternity services. We know that last year, the minister set up the Maternal Disparities Task Force, which started with regular meetings. They're, I gather, going to have another meeting this month, but there's been a lull in activity, and that's not good enough. But predominantly, you have to make sure that those women who are having poor birth experiences are included, that they're put around that table and that they're listened to, because they are the ones who know that they're not getting the pain relief in a timely manner. They're the ones who know that they're facing microaggressions and indeed some outright racism, being told that you feel pain differently. And that's patently nonsense. And just wrong that that should be happening in our NHS. So I want the government to recognise that this is a problem, to accept there needs to be more training across all of those professions in the NHS, accept that we need to have people who are going to champion diversity and inclusion and make sure that Black mothers' voices and the voices of everybody from different ethnic communities and backgrounds and religions, because we know that Muslim women in particular are treated differently when they're wearing a hijab, and recognise that we need to make sure that we drive this disparity down and the women are given the support that they need through their childbirth.
Let me bring a little off Donna Ockenden, the senior midwife who's been conducting independent reviews into the maternity service failings over the past 10 years. She was joined. She joined Michelle Hussain on the Today programme earlier and had this to say.
So I think, first of all, I would say that I absolutely endorse. I read the report last night, and I hear from women on the ground that they do not feel listened to. Their views are not acted upon. They're not at the centre of their care. And one woman said to me last week, we're treated as hard to reach, but, you know, actually we're easy to ignore.
Easy to ignore. Sandra, how do you think that can be turned around?
I think Caroline Noakes definitely mentioned most of the points that I would have been happy to share, but definitely committing to being an anti-racist organisation. I know the Birth Rights Inquiry created the, you know, recommendations, making us, people like myself, Black and brown women and birthing people, decision makers in our own care and within the wider maternity system, as well as creating a, you know, safe and inclusive environment workforce culture so that everybody feels safe whilst working in the maternity system or receiving care within the maternity system as well.
And do you feel that it is racist, Sandra?
Absolutely. You cannot deny that race has a lot to do with the ill treatment of Black and brown birthing people. You know, the statistics back it up. My experiences and, you know, are echoed with hundreds, thousands of other Black and brown women's experiences in, you know, accessing care. And also the lack of understanding around cultural differences and barriers, which is why it's really important to have education and training around what it is like being a Black mother accessing or going through the maternity system as well.
Listening also to some people talking about this report, Caroline, they did talk about wider medical conditions and mental health conditions that can be at the root of why Black maternal health and also Asian maternal health can be so precarious for these women. I mean, surely it's larger than outside of the maternity services.
Oh, absolutely. This is an enormous multifaceted problem, and it's about underlying health conditions, comorbidities, it's about housing conditions, it's about education, it's about making sure that women are supported not just during their pregnancies but pre-conception, but most of all it's about making sure that women are listened to and understood and not ignored. And whilst we all recognise it's not going to be a very simple, you know, here's the silver bullet, this solves it, it's going to be really complicated. But look at things like Professor Marmot's report talking about socioeconomic disparities, and then reflect about those people who are living in the poorest housing conditions, in the most deprived neighbourhoods, and recognise that they need targeted support and intervention, that they need to make sure that continuity of carer is prioritised for people who might have complex pregnancies, and whether that's, you know, high blood pressure or whether it's diabetes. We have to recognise that across the piece, there's an enormous number of challenges that have to be addressed to make sure that Black women are treated as well as they possibly can be, and that we don't continue to see this disparity. Because if we're back here in 20 years, say, oh, well, you know, it's shifted a little bit, but it's still only 2.5 times more, that's still a failure, isn't it?
But is this, as Sandra said, she very much sees it as racism. Some others might see it as an issue of deprivation of poverty.
Oh, look, it's really complicated, and there are elements of deprivation. There is no doubt about that. There are elements of underlying health conditions. There are elements of not having continuity of carer and levels of safe staffing. But equally, time and again, the message we get from the Birth Rights Inquiry, the message that we get from Five Times More, the message that we get across those women who have been surveyed and given information, and Donna Ockenden's report acknowledged that there were 9,000 pieces of missing ethnicity data. We're just not collecting it accurately enough. The data isn't there to support interventions that are needed. And it's going to take a whole of government approach. So yes, of course, the Department for Housing, Levelling Up and Housing needs to look at people's housing conditions. We need to work more with the Department for Transport about air pollution in specific neighborhoods, because we know that that produces poor outcomes for babies, and recognize that this is a whole of government approach. It isn't enough to say, look, this is the Department for Health's problem. Actually, we have to address everything together in order to change this statistic.
And Sandra, let me turn back to you and kind of throw that point to you as well about whether it's about poverty and deprivation, or indeed, do you really feel it was down to the color of your skin?
Really down to the color of my skin. Mm-hmm. In fact, the traumatic experience I had whilst giving birth, you know, the midwife then proceeded to ask me, you know, what do I do for a living? And I told her, and you saw her body language actually started to change. She then gave me a private room, offered me tea and coffee, some toast, and her tone changed. And the care that she gave to me after finding out, you know, my profession, I wish I had that upon entry of the hospital. So I clearly knew that she had stereotyped me and, you know, had preconceived notions about who I was just because of the way I looked as a Black woman coming into maternity care. So I think race has more to do with the reasons for these poorer outcomes for Black and brown birthing people.
What would you say today to, let's say, a young Black woman is going in to give birth or has found out that she's pregnant. I mean, how does she navigate the system with the way it is, with the horror stories, quite simply, that you have relayed?
I mean, it's quite frightening, but I also would want to encourage a Black mother to be a real advocate for yourself. You know, before giving birth, I had no idea about these statistics, and I had to quickly turn into my biggest advocate. I'd say make sure that you trust your own instincts. And once you raise your concern the first time and they ignore you, keep raising them until you're listened to, you know, and making sure that you get a second opinion. And if you can afford a doula, please do get a doula as well, to make sure that you have somebody on behalf of you who can speak as well. If you're feeling that you are experiencing ill treatment because of racism, whether it's covert, overt, again, raise that concern and make sure that it's escalated.
That's Sandra Igwe from the Motherhood Group that supports Black mothers. And we also heard from the MP, Caroline Noakes. Now, the Department of Health and Social Care told us in a statement, the NHS is already one of the safest places to give birth in the world. But the department is, and I quote, absolutely clear that we must ensure maternity care is of the same high standard regardless of race. The government also said the Maternity Disparities Task Force, made up of mothers, clinicians and key organisations, is focusing on how to eradicate disparities and improve maternity outcomes for all mothers. Now, as I was listening back to that interview, some of you were getting in touch on 84844. Here's one. Good morning. I never message these programs, but thoroughly enjoy listening to you. Thank you very much. At this time, I feel compelled to partake. Off Jamaican heritage, my daughter had her second child last year and was treated like a third-class citizen, never mind second. She was discharged shortly after giving birth, even though she expressed how much pain she was in. After discharge, she returned to the maternity unit due to the pain and awful discharge from her wound, after having a cesarean section. Again, she was sent home. Over the next day or two, her condition deteriorated and she was eventually blue-lighted in an ambulance as she had sepsis. I do not need to say more. Well, thank you for messaging. Another here from Gina. I'm an Asian woman, UK born, whose birthing experience was very difficult. After traumatic emergency C-section, where they didn't insert a catheter, they did so after surgery and without any pain relief. They refused to give me any pain medication. And when asked, they said, you should be strong enough to take this. You don't need it. It still makes me feel sick and saddened when I have to recall this. More needs to be done to support women of colour. We are not seen, we're marginalised, and our voices are not heard. Well, I hope your voice was heard this morning, Jana, and thank you for getting in touch. 84844. You may know the government is preparing to launch the first nationwide test of a new emergency alert system on our smartphones. That's this coming Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Domestic abuse charities are concerned about the potential risk to domestic abuse survivors. I'm joined by Ellie Butt, Head of Policy, Public Affairs and Research at the charity Refuge. Welcome, Ellie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So why are you concerned particularly about this alert system?
So we're worried about survivors of domestic abuse that have a hidden phone or a secret phone. And this is quite common because of a rise in what's termed technology facilitated abuse, where perpetrators might have cloned a phone and be monitoring all usage. They might be checking who a woman's calling, what website she's going on. So that can be really difficult for a woman to keep in touch with family and friends, or perhaps she wants to work with a specialist domestic abuse organisation, plan to leave, find out what her options are. So women sometimes have a secondary phone that's hidden from the perpetrator, and the alert could alert the perpetrator to the fact there is a phone in the house. So it's really important that women who are at risk because of their hidden phone know how to turn off the alerts and turn those off before the test on Sunday afternoon.
And that's why you're here. So what's exactly expected to happen on Sunday, and what are you advising people?
So on Sunday at 3 p.m. there'll be a siren type noise that will go onto all phones that are connected to 4 or 5G. The alert will make a sound even if they're on silent or do not disturb. So these can be switched off, and there's lots of detail about how you can do this for different providers on the Refuge website. But in summary, you need to go into your settings, search for emergency alerts, and then toggle off emergency and severe alerts, and then it won't make a sound. And if you've got a device that you really don't want to be discovered by someone in your home, then it won't make a sound.
The Cabinet Office have just told us this. Let me see. The alert goes out as a signal sent from mobile masts. If a phone is switched off or on flight mode, then it won't receive the signal. However, because the signal will continue to be broadcast for up to 30 minutes, if a phone is switched back on in that time, then it will receive the alert. If the alerts are disabled on a phone or it remains switched off for longer, then it will not receive it.
Yeah, so we're advising survivors of domestic abuse with a hidden phone to switch them off, because of course the test, we know when that's going to be, and that's really well publicised. But the point of this system is to warn people about emergencies. So in future, these alerts, we won't know exactly when they're coming, but there might be a flood in a particular area or some other issue that the government want to alert us to. So if you are at risk because you've got a hidden phone, we really advise you to switch them off.
Oh, so this isn't really just about the emergency alert system this time. It could be any time.
Absolutely. The Cabinet Office have launched this programme so they can alert us to emergencies in particular areas. Of course, this is really important. And most survivors will have a primary phone as well that they will receive these alerts on. But what we're really concerned about is these hidden phones that women are using for their safety, or so they're not so isolated. And that could be a real risk if perpetrators discover that women have a secret phone. So we're urging them to switch those off. And there's lots of help and support if they need it.
And Ellie, I mean, do you think that message is getting out? I know you're here and talking about it today, but, you know, sometimes these, even about the emergency alert system, it may not be that everybody's copped it.
Absolutely. That's a real risk, a real concern. So we're doing what we can to promote the fact that this test is coming, and these tests can be, the alerts can be switched off if you need them to. And we really urge the government to keep promoting this message as well, that they can be switched off if they're going to cause you a risk of harm.
And your guide on how to do this is on the Women's Hour website and our social media at BBC Women's Hour, just to let people know about that. Just before I let you go, though, the online safety bill is back before the House of Lords tomorrow. Refuge and also the violence and against women sector are calling for a code of practice to be brought in. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Absolutely. So there's a real gap in the online safety bill still, even though it's reaching near the end of its legislative journey. At the moment, the bill doesn't say anything explicitly about women or girls or what platforms need to do to prevent and better respond to the abuse that takes place on their platforms. So with a coalition of charities and academics, we've written a VOGUE, Violence Against Women and Girls, VOGUE code of practice that we want to be added to the bill. There's already codes on terrorism and child sexual exploitation and abuse. We really need the government to fill the gap so that social media companies know exactly what they need to do in order to stop their platforms being abused by perpetrators. There's an amendment that's been tabled to that effect, led by Baroness Nicky Morgan, and we're really calling on the government to look at that amendment and accept it, because it will make it a stronger bill.
Ellie Butt, Head of Policy, Public Affairs and Research at the Charity Refuge, thanks so much. Just want to go back for a moment to Black maternal care that we were talking about. Message from Mary. I'm a retired midwife. I'm outraged with the allegations that Black and Asian women are treated differently to white women. In my experience over many years of practice, I never witnessed any difference in care. All pregnant women, despite race, were all treated on their symptoms and not on the colour of their skin. Keep your experiences coming. 84844 is our text number, and at BBC Women's Hour is our social media handle, or of course you can email us through our website as well. Love to hear from you. Right, I want to move on, I suppose, about phones in a way. It's about court, it's about a play, and there is of course one of, I suppose, very much watched court trial. It was October 2019. There was months of amateur sleuthing. Colleen Rooney, the wife of footballer Wayne Rooney. So she revealed, if you're online, in a series of dramatic Instagram posts, who she suspected of selling her private stories to the tabloid newspapers. If you remember, Rooney explained that she had blocked all of her social media followers on one private account, except for one person. And she posted fake stories to try and smoke out the culprit. She ended the post when she figured it out. It's Rebecca Vardy's account. Yes, her fellow wag, you'll remember the tag given to wives and girlfriends of footballers, and the wife of footballer Jamie Vardy. So the infamous sting operation and the accusations that led to this very high profile libel trial between the two at the High Court last year. Who came up with the Agatha Christie trial? So the legal tussle, it has moved from the Royal Courts of Justice to London's West End stage. I had the pleasure of watching it last week. Vardy v Rooney, the Agatha Christie trial. It's on in the Ambassador's Theatre. I do see over it. It's beside Agatha Christie's mousetrap, and they have on there is the scouse trap. It's on until the 20th of May, and then it's going on tour all around the country. Let me bring in to Woman's Hour adapter Liv Hennessy. Good morning.
Hello, nice to meet you.
And we have director Lisa Sperling also with us. Let us start with the tagline. We couldn't make this story up, so we didn't. Tell us about that.
I think for us, when we were first approaching this play, it just kind of had all the ingredients of a really great drama. There was mystery, betrayal, lots of celebrity culture, legal terminology. So I think for us, we sort of felt we couldn't make it up. And it was such a real moment in time that we decided to stage it.
Well, let's talk about the staging of it. Lisa, do you want to describe it? I mean, I was kind of taken with the green when I first walked in.
It's a courtroom setting in the sense of that you have the seat for the judge, you have your witness box, you have your kind of area, which is where the barrister and their clients sit. But you also, because of the connection to the football world that this play has, it's on a pitch in the sense of that. And we also, Liv's genius was to bring in our pundits, who are essentially our narrators, who take us through the action and are able to compress 7 days worth of court trials down into 90 minutes plus injury time, as you would with a football match.
They're excellent. They also play some of the other characters. For example, yeah. Rebecca Vardy's agent on one side, Wayne Rooney at another point.
They do indeed. So you've got, they also play Jamie Vardy and Harpreet Robinson, who is the FA official. And so they're able to give us a sense of the world also outside of the court, because obviously there are only certain people that came to the court. Particularly, we didn't have Caroline Watt, and Jamie Vardy was mainly outside of the court.
Yes. So we kind of get to see inside, because these are verbatim court transcripts. I can't underline that enough. Let's talk about using them. There is a long history of turning court transcripts into plays, but often more serious situations, I think my listeners might be familiar with. But this?
Yeah, obviously it's a bit different to the kind of normal stuff. I mean, at Tricycle Theatre now, Kiln Theatre many years ago, they did the sort of tribunal play. So like The Riots, Bloody Sunday. This was very different. It was 7 days of court transcripts sort of like filtered down into a very short play, really. And that's why we sort of needed the pundits, because, I mean, when I approached this, first of all, I did not know anything about libel law. And
are you an expert now?
I actually think I am, yeah. So I think it was a really tough thing to approach an audience with, and that's why we needed those pundits to come in and explain things like waiving source protection and explain the way the reverse burden of proof works. And in my mind, all I wanted to do was to explain very complicated legal terms, like it's the offside rule, and that was my main thing as I went through. So yeah, that's sort of why we have the pundits, for comic effect and also for some clarity.
Shall we listen to a little? In this, we will hear Lucy May Barker playing Rebecca Vardy and Tom Turner playing Colleen Rooney's barrister, David Sherborne, QC. Here is Sherborne questioning Vardy on the stand about the private WhatsApp messages that she sent to her then-agent, Caroline Watt.
Can we turn to the next example? Page 1951. The next example refers to someone called Mrs. F in order to protect her identity. Just to give this some context, Mrs. F's a well-known celebrity, right?
That's correct, yes.
And Mr. H is her estranged husband. They were separated due to marital difficulties. And Mr. G is a well-known footballer. Now, without giving away too much information, there were some pictures of Mrs. F on a beach, dancing round, wearing relatively little clothing. Let's read together what you said to Caroline Watt.
Oh, my God, have you seen how badly Mrs. F is behaving?
And she says...
I haven't seen it. Oh, look.
And you say...
Leak the story about her shagging Mr. G behind Mr. H's back.
I tried before, but the son already knew about it and couldn't prove it as usual.
To which you respond...
Ugh!
What you say is, ugh, you're annoyed you can't leak it, aren't you?
It's more like an ugh, not an ugh.
You're annoyed, aren't you?
No, I was actually just joking about that one.
You were just joking?
Yes, I was.
You use the word leak, don't you?
I did use the word leak, but that's not what I meant.
Oh, I see. You don't know what the word leak means, then?
Well, there are two meanings, but that's not what I meant by the word leak.
You say this is a joke. Is that your evidence to the court?
Tom Turner playing David Sherborne QC and Lucy May Barker, as I mentioned, playing Rebecca Vardy. The lighting is fantastic as well. And apart from putting the spotlight on these characters, it also puts a spotlight on what about our private messages stands up to public scrutiny. I was asking my listeners about that, but they might be a bit shy about answering, which
why.
Many are, I think. But how much do you think, as well, what we're seeing in that trial is somewhat a reflection of society today?
I think it definitely is. I think for us, we thought about this play as a comedy of manners, a sort of modern look at contemporary society and what is a friend, what is a follower, how sort of relationships operate online. It's very different to how it used to be. So, yeah, I think with that sort of... I think the reason that people are laughing quite often is because it's the public meets private. So you have Rebecca Vardy on the stand, her public persona. She's poised, she's smart. And then you go into her private messages and she's saying something completely different. And I think that's why people laugh, because I think a lot of us feel the same about that.
So you think there's a identifiable aspect?
Definitely.
Because during the trial, there were criticisms, as both of you will have seen, of course, that people were laughing at two working class women who were out of their depth in the courtroom. I'd be curious, Lisa, as well, about how you feel about that criticism.
Part of the reason I wanted to do this and I got involved was I felt like it was a chance to actually see more of these women and in their own words, both the WhatsApp messages, but also to see so much more of what they spoke about when they're in the witness box, and particularly for Colleen, but also for Vardy, this sense of, in Colleen's case, a woman that has been in the public eye since she was 16 years old, and that they have put up in some way with the amount of scrutiny and the sort of obsession of the media and the press and the public. And when we talk about private messages, but also talk about social media, for me, I feel like this story is about... is in some ways about control, is about two women who are trying to control the narrative about their lives. And they've gone about it in very different ways. And one is to go on social media and to share it only with their private followers. And when that has gone public in some way, they've tried to bring back control. And in Vardy's case, there's a sense of going, well, someone has said something about me and the rest of the world now has an opinion, and I now need to try and change that opinion. And the moment that we're in terms of what you publish publicly or privately and the blurred lines between those two things, you know, we've had lots of conversation with people who work in the legal system, and they talk about this as a landmark case, in the sense of in 10 years time we may well be in a point where when we, you know, we follow someone on Twitter or we follow their we're unable to follow them on Instagram, that there'll be a terms and conditions about what you sign up for, about what you won't share or you know,
so before I follow somebody I've got to
and I think now there's a moral obligation, a moral code that goes, well, if I've let you into my inner circle and you're considered a friend, whatever that means on social media, you're not going to share that in some way. But those lines feel really blurred at the moment. And I also think we're really bad in this country for kind of almost pulling people down because they want to share something of themselves, or they want to be more popular, or they want to in some ways monetize the way that they're working and everything else. But everybody is doing it. We're all marketing a version of ourselves, and we sort of pull them down if it goes too far.
So do you feel then, Lisa, there's almost a snobbery about people making money in this way?
Totally. And there's also a sense of, you know, working class women done good. And the fact that the sense of for these women that they've ridden on their husbands' coattails because they're footballers. And actually everything we found about these two women by studying the trial, the research that we've done, is that they're intelligent, they're confident, they're really clear. Like the level of research that they've done into the case themselves, what they presented for themselves, they're fighting their own battle to a certain extent.
Do you not feel, though, that the audience is laughing at them?
I think they start off laughing at them. And I think the gesture for me is that they come in and they're presented with something that feels, excuse me, slightly ridiculous, slightly over the top. As you say, you couldn't make it up, so we didn't. And they can't quite believe it. But my hope is that when they come away from the trial, they're asking big questions about the public domain and relationships and society today. Because there's this incredible moment, I don't want to give it away, where one of the barristers talks about the abuse that Vardy has received, and they say that some of that abuse out loud, and the audience finds that hilariously funny. And then they say something else and the audience kind of goes, oh, that's a bit dodgy. And then they say something else and they go, oh, you've gone too far. And I think we relish in other people's lives and what's happening, and yet we then pull them down when it's gone too far.
It almost reminds me, now that you're talking about it, like a Shakespearean drama.
Yeah,
you know, when the audience is like
totally.
In there. I mean, I've been, as I keep telling my listeners, to 3 plays last week, and this one most definitely was rowdy. And I mean that in a really good way. I don't mean in the way that we're reading about in some of the papers at the moment. I loved it, I have to say. And I think it's an awful lot of food for thought, and particularly between the private and the public. So it's going to go on tour as well, I've noticed, which is going to be very exciting. I did have an idea for another play for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you watching Gwyneth Paltrow's?
Yeah.
Is that knowing smiles that I'm looking at?
No, not at all. It's a couple of people have mentioned, obviously, in the Depp trial as well, of what it is. But I feel there's something... You know, you even mentioned who came up with the coin of Wagatha Christie. I feel like Twitter and other social media can be really negative, but where British humour or British punditry does incredibly well is at these taglines. The fact that you've got, you know, Wagatha Christie, Scouse Trap, there's a genius behind it. And this feels like a very... British trial and a British conversation. And I don't know if it would happen in other countries in the same way. I don't know if we get obsessed.
I think as well with the Gwyneth Paltrow case, that was very different to what's happening here. Something that really drew us to this case is because it's a libel case. And what is so fascinating is that Wagatha Christie is a very clear illustration of a precedent that exists in the UK, which is that people of great wealth are capable of legally protecting their reputations. And another thing for me, like obviously I've got an arts background, so coming to a legal case was very daunting, but I've always seen the law as a kind of like very much black and white. There are answers to it, and in the arts it tends to be a bit more nebulous. But actually what I found when I looked into libel law was that fascinatingly the burden of proof is that like what constitutes a public figure, there's nothing fixed to that. People have to constantly fight that out in court. What's the metric for the damage of someone's reputation? There's a lot of intricacies that exist here. And to be honest, these are the quiet powers that do exist in the UK. And we're interested in showing them in a way that's fun and accessible.
Well, it was. Vardy versus Rooney, the Wagatha Christie trial runs at the Ambassador's Theatre until the 20th of May, then goes on tour to Woking, Liverpool, Southend, Dublin, Salford and Brighton. I think you'll have audience enjoying it all through that. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I want to... A lot of you still getting in touch about Black Maternal Health, 84844. I will read some of your messages before the end of the programme. But I want you to meet another of the incredible women who made this year's Women's Hour Power List. This year, made up of women in sport. The list features remarkable women across the board. Our finalists, you might remember, were split into 5 categories. I'm delighted to be joined by another of our change makers. So those disrupting the status quo and changing the future of women's sport as we know it. It is Ellie Downey, a former British Olympic gymnast and European champion, who in 2020 took the brave step to speak out publicly about the culture of physical and mental abuse in that sport, in gymnastics. Her accounts of weight shaming that she experienced throughout her career, along with the testimonies of her sister Becky and many other former British gymnasts, led to a major independent review. Now, the findings of that, which were last year, revealed a shocking catalogue of systemic abuse in which athletes were made to train on injuries, punished for needing the toilet, sat on by coaches, shouted and sworn at, and also had their bags searched for food. Now, British Gymnastics have since published a 40-point action plan, which they say will address and go beyond the recommendations made by the review. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But for Ellie, speaking out as she did, she says it had a major impact on her career and her mental health. And in January of this year, announced she would be stepping back from the sport. So much that was going on. Ellie, welcome.
Hiya.
So good to have you with us and lovely to see your face again, as I do since I did at the Paralist Day, which was great to have you there. Now, you, as I mentioned, decided to speak up about what you witnessed while training as a gymnast along with your sister. Talk our listeners through a little bit of what it was that you experienced.
Yeah, so I think like in gymnastics, a lot of the things that we experienced was just classed as normal and what you needed to do to kind of get to the top. And I can only speak from my experience, really, but I had a lot of weight shaming throughout my career, which was ultimately just having a massive impact on my mental health. And I mean, I started the sport when I was 3 years old and started kind of getting weighed when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So, you can see how like over the years it would take a bit of a impact on your mental health, kind of constantly being told you're not like the correct body type to be a gymnast, or like you need to lose muscle, you've got too much of it. And for me, that was always really hard for me to understand, because I was always being pretty successful and winning medals and was always on national teams and stuff. So I could never really come to terms with why they always thought I wasn't good enough to kind of be doing the stuff that I was doing. And for me, that was always hard to just kind of get my head around, and yeah, just took a bit of a mental toll on me. So
yes, and then you did speak out. You were still competing when you put out that statement. You and your sister Becky were the only British athletes that were competing that did speak up. And I'm wondering where that courage came from, particularly after being, it sounds like, beaten down for all those years.
Yeah, I think it kind of stemmed from the Netflix documentary Athlete A, and then I think people within like British gymnastics kind of just started we're also in lockdown at this point, so a lot of time to kind of think about stuff that had happened, and some of the other girls who weren't on the program had started to come out, and me and Becky just thought it'd be really powerful for kind of us who are currently on the program to speak out about our experiences. But unfortunately for us, I don't think it really worked in our favor. I think people didn't really like us for doing it who within the program, and I think me and my sister would both say the same, that we definitely suffered some consequences in terms of making teams and kind of treatment after that for doing it. So
Was it overt?
It was more like just like we'd go to national camps and people wouldn't speak to us, and like mainly from like the coaches and stuff like that, like people weren't very welcoming towards us after that. And just things circling, like you should be careful about helping them because they might try and like take you down, because they saw it as like a big threat that we kind of spoken out. And I mean, for me and my sister, we only spoke about your experiences that actually happened, so it's not kind of our fault that those things had happened and been allowed to happen over the years. So for us, kind of like feeling like we're getting punished after that was not fair.
Yeah, did you, is regret the right word? I don't know. Speaking out.
It's not a regret, but sometimes I think would things have been a lot different if I hadn't done it? Like, I don't regret it because I do think it's pushing the sport in the right direction very slowly. But at the same time, I do think things could have been differently in terms of like some teams I would have made, and it could have just taken my career in a different direction. So
I do have a statement from British Gymnastics. I'll read a little. They say, Ellie has been a tremendous ambassador for the sport, and in speaking up about her experiences has been part of helping us to reform the sport. We've spoken with her in depth and are committed to doing so. They talk about undergoing significant recent change and has very different leadership of both the organisation and the performance programme, and that they're committed to learning from the past and published Reform 25, a comprehensive 40-point action plan to address and also go beyond the recommendations of the White Review. You did decide, however, though, in the aftermath of speaking out, to retire from gymnastics. And I can't imagine, because you've just talked about all that you went through, taking that moment to speak out, and then this way you feel you were treated after speaking out, to then leave the thing that you loved and were, of course, so amazingly good at.
Yeah, it was definitely wasn't an easy decision. I mean, within all this time as well of like us speaking out and COVID and like just a lot of uncertainty. Like our brother passed away as well, so like there was just a lot going on at that time, and I just didn't really feel like I had some of the support that I needed. And I kind of made the decision to give it like one more go last year and really try and come back and make a team. And I ended up being first reserve after kind of doing things that I got told if I would do X, Y, Z to make the team, then I would kind of be going. And I kind of did that and didn't get picked still. So I was just like, I don't really know what to do. Like my life feels very out of control. I feel like no matter what I do, I'm not going to make a team again. So then I just kind of made the decision to step back, retire. I took some time out of the gym and I just felt a lot better for it. So, ultimately it wasn't easy. It took me a lot of months to kind of come to terms with it and just like be in my own thoughts and really think about the decision long and hard. But I know how like, I'm so much happier now. I feel like I don't have all of that mental stress and pressure every single day. And like just like some of the mistreatment was just not nice, and I just don't think you should kind of treat people like that. It's not I don't think it's normal.
Yeah, I mean, something else that's quite unusual is that your sister is still competing, and I saw, you know, how much you are cheering her on from the sidelines. Her team won gold and a personal silver at the European Championships over the past few days, and I'm wondering, is that bittersweet?
Not really, because I've kind of like, if I'd never like been there and done it myself, I think I would look at it and be like, oh, I like really wish I was there. But I've been to a lot of European Championships and a lot of World Championships and the Olympics, so I kind of don't look back and really regret anything. Like I can happily just watch her and really support her, because I know it's not been easy for her either, and like her mental strength is just insane to keep going and keep training and keep winning medals. So
but do you feel for Becky now, for example, and that world of gymnastics and girls coming up after her, of course, is it different? You know, I read a little bit of what British gymnastics are saying.
I mean, like I said, I can only speak from my experiences, yes. But even what I experienced like at the back end of last year, for me, it hasn't changed. I didn't think it was changing fast enough. And I know there's like people within the sport who aren't agreeing and have actually decided to step away, like professionals, not necessarily the gymnasts, but other professionals. So I think, I don't know. Yeah, I think it's maybe changing very, very slowly. But yeah, I still think they've got a long way to go. So.
You spoke about your experiences and your sister made the statement as well, as I mentioned. But when that White Review released its findings, there was physical, there was emotional abuse for many girls. Were you surprised by that?
No, because I feel like I'd witnessed quite a lot of it. Like I wasn't like physically abused in any ways, and like I saw some people like shutting cupboards and like being hit and stuff like that. That I didn't really experience any of that, but like the mental side, I would probably say 90% of gymnasts definitely have experienced some kind of like mental kind of abuse, I would say. And I almost hate using the word abuse because it sounds so strong and powerful, but when you like really think about it, like it kind of is. So
yes, and that's your experience. If there was one change that came faster than the others, what would you like that to be?
I guess just to like always put the gymnast first. And like, I think sometimes the decisions aren't made like jointly. I think it's sometimes too heavily one-sided by the coaches. And I would just like that to become a little bit more, because at the end of the day, like gymnasts are really starting to get older in the sport now. I think they felt like they had a lot of control over you because you were a senior when you turned 16. So you're no age when you're 16. And I think they just felt like they could make a lot of decisions for you because you were essentially a child. So I just think that everybody's getting older, and even like still the younger kids, they need to have a lot more say in like what they're doing. And obviously it's like a 50-50 relationship. You've got to trust your coach, and they also have to trust you as well. And like if the gymnast wants to work hard, then they will. So
So making it gymnast-centred, which of course on the outside you might think it would be that, but I understand what you're saying. Let us turn to something very positive, making it to number four on the Women's Hour power list. How did you find out and how does it feel?
Well, I knew I was on the list when I got invited to like the announcement of it, but I didn't know where I'd placed. And I think as like you announced it all in sections, I think as the sections got on, I was getting a bit more and more apprehensive. But to just be in the mix with people like Leah Williamson and Dina Asher-Smith, it's kind of mind-blowing to me. Like, they're such amazing sports stars. And for me to come number four, it's just, yeah, pretty incredible. So...
Well, we're so glad that you are, and thank you so much for chatting with us. And we'll be really excited to see what you do in your future months. I'm glad to hear that you're feeling more stable and more grounded in these weeks and months since you retired.
Thank you.
Ellie Downey, one of our women on the Women's Hour power list. Thanks for everyone getting in touch. Let me see. We're talking about Black maternal health a little earlier. I'm a third generation Caribbean woman. I had our daughter by emergency C-section. That was in 2019. But my husband and I have doctor titles due to having PhDs. I believe my title, being an academic, being married, and also that we live in a sought after area, led me to being treated wonderfully. I stayed in hospital for 10 days to be monitored. I was made to feel listened to and respected. I do think your background and preconceived ideas, sadly, do impact on how you are treated. I always wondered if I was a single mom on benefits, would I have been mistreated? And that's Dr. Isabel. Another here, let me see, Angela. My experience is that in each of my three pregnancies, it was never acknowledged the level of pain I was in and how close I was to giving birth. After my first pregnancy and when in labour with my second and third, I refused to leave when they tried sending me home. And it was the right decision as I gave birth shortly after. If I hadn't refused, I would have given birth on transit home, increasing levels of risk. Nothing has changed. I must say midwives are wonderful, but differences in race and the individual support needs to be acknowledged and addressed to save the lives of women and their babies. I welcome this discussion. Keep them coming. 84844. Now, I want to turn to something a little different. Small pipes. We are joined by Bridget Heinbull, multi-award winning small piper who is breaking stereotypes and proving that the pipes are not just for men in kilts. She has recently released her first solo album. She's performing later this week at the Folk Weekend. When did you start playing and what attracted you to the small pipes?
Thank you so much. I started learning the pipes when I was very young. I think I was around 7 or 8. But that was mainly the Highland pipes. I started with the more popular big bagpipes. But when I was around 14 or 15, I met two guys, Finn and Hamish Moore. Hamish was involved in the kind of revival of the instrument in the late 80s, 90s. And was the first kind of person to remake them in kind of a modern world. And they gave me a set to try. And since then, I've just loved them and they've become my instrument.
Could you describe them?
Yeah, so...
Compared to the Highland pipes, for example, that people might be familiar with.
Yeah, so like technically they're very similar, but sound-wise they're a lot more mellow. That's due to them being blown by a set of bellows rather than with your mouth. So you have a bellow strapped to your elbow and the air goes through these bellows. So it's kind of cold air rather than like warm air from your mouth. So it kind of affects the tone.
And why do you think there are less women playing these pipes?
I think historically piping has been quite a male-dominated area. I mean, you know, social history and then the military adapted the pipes. But there's definitely more women playing the pipes now and there's a great support network in the world of piping. So
I know you're going to be playing at the Folk Weekend. There's one song, The Call of the Redshank. Is it Pililu?
Am I
close to pronunciation?
Yeah, that's it.
And so tell us a little bit about this song.
Yeah, so this song comes from my new album, which was out just a few days ago. And it's basically based on the call of the bird, the red shank. So pilu is kind of the vocables of the bird, and kind of based on Gaelic vocables. And this is just the melody of the song.
And where do you start if you're going to compose a piece?
I think there's two kind of paths I take personally. One is kind of taking a piece of traditional material, whether it be a song or a tune, and kind of that would be my starting point, and improvising from there. The other one is just starting from scratch and picking like a drone tuning or a certain mode. So that would just be like certain notes that I pick on the chanter of the pipes and just play around with that until I kind of come up with a melody.
Do you think little girls will start picking up the small pipes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you like the sound of the pipes, you should go for it. The small pipes are great. They're very diverse. You can play with lots of different instruments. They're great fun, so I would absolutely encourage that.
With a very big smile, as you say it as well. Thanks so much for joining us on Woman's Hour. So lovely to have your music. That's Bríde Hainball, small piper, as she is, and playing this weekend, as I mentioned, at the Folk Weekend. I want to go back to some of your messages before we end the programme. We're talking about maternal care. Here's Charmaine. She says, today we're focusing on maternal care, black maternal care. But the frightening truth is it's not limited to maternity care. If we choose to look, we'll see the same disparities across other areas of health, education, the criminal justice system, employment. The list is just endless. If we choose to step back and take a holistic view, we have to accept that there is systemic racism in the UK. Whether it's deliberate or not is irrelevant. The fact is a significant proportion of our law-abiding, hard-working, tax-paying population is routinely and casually discriminated against, and that results in the unnecessary loss of life and lifelong trauma. Thanks for your messages. Tomorrow. Have you been watching Race Across the World? Well, the BBC One programme where travellers can choose any route they like, but no flights or phones. It's phones today we keep talking about. Tomorrow, I'll be joined by Cathy and Tricia, two best friends setting out on the journey of a lifetime. Join me tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
What happens when a life coach takes over your life? For the last 18 months, I've been investigating claims that a UK mentoring company is actually a cult.
What we're doing is helping human beings actually gain control of themselves, not for us to gain control of you.
I don't know who I am anymore, bro. Absolutely no idea.
The only money he had to give them was his house.
Controlling its members.
It was more about apportioning blame to my parents.
These toxic groups called families.
Intimidating critics.
When I'd ask questions.
They said, if you leave and you turn against us, we have all those personal recordings of yours.
We'll come for you next.
How do you feel, Paul, about the fact that so many people think you're running a cult?
We're not running a cult. Because they don't know what a cult is. They're slurring us. They're smearing us.
I'm Katrin Nye, and from BBC Radio 4, this is A Very British Cult. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.